Welcome to The Crucible, where the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy gives you a front row seat to conversations with specialists in the minerals and metals sector. SIAM has well over 100 years' experience in and commitment to protecting the professional standards of our industry. Join us now as we discuss the key issues and global initiatives to give you the relevant information needed to make informed decisions, to influence policy that directly affects our sector, and to help our industry grow in an uncertain future.
Good day and welcome to The Crucible, the SIMM podcast that allows us to connect and most importantly be in touch with developments in the mining and minerals industry. I'm Kondwani, the Great Panda, and today in the studio I have Arjen de Bruin, the CEO of OIM Consulting. So just a quick intro into Arjen. With business improvement experience since 1991, when I was born, Arjen has served in leadership positions at consulting firms for the past 27 years in an operational capacity. He has successfully led business improvement projects for several prominent South African companies. Over the past 5 years, he has been invited as a speaker to several local conferences, and numerous of his thought leadership articles have been published in Prominent Mining and other publications. Arjen believes relationships are fundamental to delivering successful projects, so he enjoys working with clients that are passionate about their business, have a clear realization of challenges they face, as well as courage and conviction to take action that cuts to the core of the critical factors, even when unconventional and unpopular. Welcome, Arjen.
Hey, thank you, Oni.
So, Arjen, it's on to you to take me through your career journey from when you started until this present moment as the CEO of OIM Consulting, and what the journey has been like for you as well as OIM as an organization.
Absolutely. Now, wonderful. So I'll take you through my whole journey, because people always look at my name and go, huh, we see the De Bruin, that sounds South African, but the origin, where does that come from? And so I'm Dutch born. I was born in Amsterdam. And at the age of 3, I followed my parents to Zambia. The reason was that they were feeding me, and I thought I better just join them. So I joined them when they moved to Zambia. So I lived in Zambia for about 4 years, moved to Namibia, stayed there for about 7 years, and then to Cape Town. Finished my schooling there. I studied industrial psychology, but I'm not an industrial psychologist. I keep on telling people that. I kind of got bored with varsity, so I moved on. And then basically I swore blind, I'm going to do an honors and a master's, but it just never happened in the end. And then I got into Sanlam insurance company. I was appointed as a productivity and process analyst around about 1991. And what happened there was it was perfect. We literally landed when the whole business process reengineering started. And the things like automation, which we would now call digitization, but then they called it automation. And it was brilliant. So I was there for about four or five years. And my claim to fame is, I mean, it sounds really weird, is I got Sanlam to be the first insurance company to use email for clients, because everything used to be post, and I got them to do internet. Yeah. But just getting that done was it was like, where's the business guys? I'm like, based on what? No one was doing it. So it was really kind of weird, but quite exciting. And then I moved to Alexander Proudfoot, worked for them for a few years, and then I became a director. That's why I learned MOS, by the way. That's the Management Operating System, which I think a lot of people now know in the mining industry. And so myself and Ben now, that also works at OIM, we implemented Management Operating Systems in lots of companies. And that was quite fun. I loved the methodology. I wasn't always happy about how that was implemented, but still enjoyed the methodology. And then moved to a very small company called Rethink Management Consulting. I ran the Cape operation, and my role was to implement workflow and what they then called document management system, which is now electronic document management systems, throughout basically nearly all the insurance companies in the Cape. So I've worked at Old Mutual, Sanlam, Metropolitan, and then we moved into efficiency projects within that space, and also did some government work, and then did work for Truers, Clicks, Alan Gray on the efficiency side, and that. So that's where we blended efficiency with technology, which is pretty important because it actually is very important coming into the manufacturing mining area, specifically now obviously on the mining side. And then in 2010, I joined OIM. We were called OIM Operational Solutions, and our role in the beginning was 2010 was to basically make companies more effective and efficient through processes, the things like Lean Six Sigma, management operating systems and everything. And while the other arm of OIM was doing the culture stuff. So what we did was we basically kind of like took culture and efficiency and put it all together. And then through in that time, we created the supervisory development program, which kind of like is sort of the thing that we are now known for. So yeah, from a nice work perspective, I have done quite a bit, moved around quite a bit. So it's been fun, and obviously I still enjoy what I'm doing.
Fantastic. What would you say are some of your key highlights or key successes when it comes to your involvement with OIM Consulting?
The biggest thing that excited me about OIM Consulting is how we moved into the supervisory space. And what we now term is people-centric consulting, where in essence we say we take people, we capacitate, we look at people first, and through that we get efficiencies. And that's been quite a major mind shift, because previously our mind shift was very much on, well, if you improve processes, if you ensure that you've got the right technology in and you give people some kind of mindset change, well, whoopee, the world will be different, and that, and we've moved it, and we're not saying that you shouldn't do that. So that's the one thing. The other thing is that OIM grew. I mean, we literally we kind of like doubled after COVID. Look, we've come down a bit, but we've grown quite radically from where we were. So that's a major achievement. Obviously, the other achievement is that we are known in the market. We were pretty obscure, so we're known in the market. Project wise, I think our biggest project turnaround that we did was for South Deep for Goldfields. I mean, I'm very chuffed about the team that took something that was pretty much struggling, and we partnered with the Goldfields team and basically turned it around after 11 years of losses. That if you take a bundle of that, and I mean, obviously things like we're known to kind of like all the big mining companies, and we've got a name. So yeah, pretty happy about that.
Fantastic. And I think with today's topic, we are looking into productivity. And I think this is something that's also quite close to my heart. As a project manager, I'm very interested in terms of how people will be productive in my project, but most importantly, being able to execute within time, within scope, and within budget. So productivity is quite an important thing, not only within project management, but most especially within the mining and minerals industry as a whole. And maybe just to start with the definition of productivity. So the Cambridge Dictionary defines it as the rate at which a country, company produces goods or services, usually judged in relation to the number of people and the time necessary to produce them. And as such, productivity can be measured as labor productivity or multi-factor productivity. So a nice article that I read by David Humphreys, which is titled Mining Productivity and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, defines labor productivity as a measure of output per worker in a mining and multi-factor productivity measures the efficiency with which capital, labor, and intermediate products are converted into outputs. So in addition to multi-productivity measures, it also measures the level at which a country innovates as well as develops new technology. And another research paper that I also read by Dr. Menu Maheswari, titled A Conceptual Framework, it actually states that some factors that do influence productivity in general can be broken down to two elements, which is human factors, which are the most important. And this include the willingness to do work, the ability to do work, which then references the skills and competencies of the workforce. And then the second factor being then technological, which in this case would be the repairs and maintenance on equipment, research and development, machinery and equipment, and so on. So just with reference to what Dr. Menu stated, the fact that human factors are the most important elements that influence productivity. Just want to get your personal view, Arjun. Do you agree with this statement? And what has been your observation in terms of some of the factors that actually impact productivity in an organization?
So I fundamentally believe that the human factor is basically the factor that causes productivity loss. And I can go through a whole range of reasons for that. And I mean, as we were chatting earlier, is South African productivity is poor overall. And I think we need to state that. I don't want people listening to the podcast thinking that we kind of like trashing on the mining industry. They're not hard workers. You know, as you heard before, we've worked in financial services, retail, government, and mining and manufacturing. So overall, South African productivity is not effective. It's not good. We range between 40 to plus minus 50% on average of available work that we're effective on, and this is through all the industries. So you might find some areas within a company doing better than the rest, but to be brutally honest, South Africans are not a productive country in all the industries, and I say that cautiously because I don't want people to think that we kind of pointing fingers at anyone, and there's a multitude of factors surrounding that, and it's your white collar and your blue collar, it's all mixed together. So there's We're all in it together, and we're all just as bad as everyone else. So we don't have to feel bad. When you go into the mining, obviously you say, well, let's look at the mining cycle. And the biggest thing there is how do you ensure that the mining cycle is basically as effective as possible? And you don't want to, in essence, don't want to have gaps in the mining cycle. And what we noticed in mining specifically is that when we work, and I'm just going all over the place, so you're gonna have to just kind of like maybe pull me back. But what we find is when we effectively work, is that we our efficiency on the time that we work is very high, but our availability is low. So what we're noticing, and I'm comparing it to the mining stats that we're seeing in Australia. So in Australia, they got high availability, but efficiency on availability is lower. While in South Africa, availability is low, and I'm generalizing now, but when we've got those hours, we work. Eh? So the issue there is how do we ensure that we work hard and yet we have the availability? Because in essence, mostly mining is about availability and efficiency on top of that. So that's the thing there. Why do I believe it's about and I do fundamentally believe people ensure that there's productivity, and you could, there's a myriad of things that cause obviously productivity not to be there through people, and the one is leadership. If you have good leaders and let's specifically say you've got good leaders and you've got focused and willing organizations, what good leaders will do is they will ensure that the culture is focused on the goal. What is the purpose of what we're doing? And we find a lot of companies struggle with or they've got purpose, but the people don't understand what is their purpose in this purpose. That kind of thing is. So we talk about the T-shirt, cap, and water bottle day, where we all say this is the vision and the mission of the company, and the next day everyone carries on as before, and leadership says, but it doesn't seem like anyone's noticing it. So we say what you need to do is you need to focus people. If you can focus people to make them understand Why? So if we say that we're a company of integrity, what does that mean? Well, that means that you don't lie about the meters you achieved. So there's integrity in your information, that kind of stuff. Well, the finance department must be, you know, their integrity would be they're not lying about the numbers and all kinds of stuff. So when people fully understand is, hang on, when I do this, this helps towards X. And when that helps towards X, that helps towards a better life for me. Because to be honest, my money lies in this company. So if I am absent from this company, I'm not making money. Or the company is not making money, that means I won't get my bonus. So hang on, let me see if I can. But if you don't get that focus, you kind of like lose it. So we find a lot of times companies are not focusing in the individual's value-adding work to what it means for them as an individual and obviously to the company. So that's the one thing. The second thing is we find is that, and this is very specific to South African environment. South African management style is very hierarchical. So I'm the boss. You do what I tell you. And what it does is it sometimes leads towards autocratic leadership. So that's the one side. On the other side, we have leaders that are in the communities and they don't want to hold the teams accountable, because if I hold my team accountable, the community will get upset with me. And there's various ways of getting upset. So what happens is it's like, well, the team has now decided to do X, and so I'll follow the team. And you might say, but that's not the best thing to do. You've got to be accountable for some things. You can't just say, well, laissez-faire, that's the team's. So you sit with that sort of hierarchical and then kind of like, I'm going to please people. And I'm not going to take accountability because I'm just worried about what will happen in the community. And these are real things. I mean, they happen. So we come along and say, well, if you focus people, you need willing people. And the only way to make sure people are willing is by ensuring that the leadership philosophy is a standard that says, this is how I treat you as an individual. It's a people first thing. I will always treat you with dignity. And you build up that whole leadership philosophy there, everyone signs off, and then you have a code of conduct to say, well, this is how we as a team will work together. And so then you focus individuals, you've got focused and willing individuals. We find that if you've got focused and willing individuals, you actually find that things start, you start getting momentum and movement. So when it comes to the whole productivity side, is if fundamentally no one understands where they're going to and they are being led haphazardly and accountability is not really a thing, that you will find is that people will not be productive, because it will be a mixture of shouting and pleasing and all that. The interesting thing there is we find is a lot of companies that we spoke to, what they immediately do is they say, let's insert more technology, or they say let's do restructures and we do process stuff. And what fundamentally happens is you implement the technology and there's never a massive uptake of technology as what you expect. So the vendor says, I'm going to sell you X. And then when you really implement it, you're going, yes, we're only getting like 20% of what we bought, because the mindsets of the people haven't changed. So you put in all this beautiful new technology and people are still running around as if it's the old way of working. Because a lot of times, this is not a criticism, this is what we observe, is a lot of times that the vendor comes along, he pulls you into workshops and he says, guys, there's going to be new equipment. We've got an IROC and that's all kind of, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, this is how it's going to work. And we pull you on and cool, you all understand. And everyone nods. Most of the time they don't really understand, but I don't know, it's going to school. And then they get sent out and the vendor says, cool, the screens are working. So are we communicating with everyone? Yes, beautiful. And we put the IROC up and then suddenly there's massive problems. And then because there's no communication and the supervisor on the ground says, stuff you, I'm not going to listen to you. And then you find out the guys that you put in to monitor the screens and give feedback are not competent to do that. And so what you then find is you find this whole thing, the technology is just not working. Not because the technology is a failure. It's because you still need people to do the technology. So you've got to get people on board here. So don't try and solve your productivity problem with just a technological solution, because you're not going to win. You're going to get some benefit, but you're just not going to win. So we say, when you're looking at massive productivity improvement. It's a very holistic thing. You need to ensure that you implement stuff in a way, because remember, technology is always going to outpace people. And I mean, suddenly you're going from an open pit to an underground mine, and you're going to retrain people. So that's a massive change in people's mindset. So you're going to make sure that you do all the things, you do the steps properly to get that right there. And then the other thing is in the context, obviously, of the stuff that we know quite well on the supervisory side, is that in South Africa, the supervisory competency levels are it's a struggle. And it's a mixture of not really being, I'm not saying not trained well, because we've been sending people away to classroom training for years, but it's the integration of information and the applicability of what they've learned in the workplace. And that doesn't really happen. And so what we're finding is that you got some guys that are good, some that aren't bad. We also find in the same environment that people are being promoted for technical reasons, not really for leadership reasons. And so what they do is they actually start working as they always used to before, when they should be leading. And we're finding in mostly in Southern Africa, is planning and organizing is your worst competency. Leading and developing second worst, and analysis and problem solving is the third worst competency. And what some of our clients are doing, they're saying, well, you know what, if I add more technology, then whoopee, it will be wonderful. And they'll work better. And we'll give them an iPad, and there's Wi-Fi to the face, and there's all kinds of stuff. Not understanding that the supervisor in a mining environment is a firefighter. He actually doesn't care about your data. And he doesn't care that you want to see these following KPIs. He's like, oh, I'm firefighting, I'm always busy. So I just want to kill the concept that we're a lazy nation, because we're not a lazy nation. But what we have noticed is that we love firefighting at that frontline leader space. We're busy as hell, but the problem is we're busy solving the same problem that recurs day in and day out. That's true. Our whole role is, let's rather work the problem out of the system. Let's plan properly. And then when you get all those building blocks in place, you start seeing productivity to rise. So what are the barriers to good productivity? It's poor leadership. Poor leadership is the number one barrier to productivity. And poor leadership can create toxic culture. And a toxic culture basically makes sure that no organization actually grows. And you will get the bare minimum out of your individuals. They literally will just do it because they need a job, or they don't care, or they're close to retirement, or whatever it's there. So leadership is basically the number one thing. The other barriers to productivity is poor processing, poor process steps, and poor management of the processes. Now, this is where big data comes along. Big data is should be able to identify immediately. Listen, those are the barriers. Let's streamline here. Let's do that. And do that. But what we've noticed a lot with big data, because there's so much big data, that people are being overwhelmed by data, and they aren't sifting the data to ensure that the analysis ensures better productivity going forward. That's the one thing. The second thing is the data is being sent to people that are not always operational. And so it takes a while for that data to refine, and then it only gets sent through to the relevant people in the operations and that. And then it's kind of like watered down, or doesn't always land where it should land. So we're saying culture, poor processes, when I say data is it lands to poor productivity in the sense of data is used incorrectly, the KPIs aren't right, and no one really knows how to handle it properly. Or it's not, the data is never compelling enough to change people. So our whole premise from an OIM point of view is information must lead to action. Now, if you've got data, that data must force someone to do action. And so if you're sending a trend analysis, the trend analysis must literally say, that's not looking good. This is what we need to do. But we find some of just getting trend analysis. And the other thing is you get trend analysis on trend analysis, crossing over trend analysis. And then you find a lot of the operations people, leadership guys go, I have no idea what you're trying to tell me here. So what is this all about? And then the person that's done the analysis goes, well, I was like, are they, what's going on? Are they stupid or what? Can't they see what I see? And then they can't. And so that becomes a barrier. The other thing also is visibility of information. We find that's a massive barrier to productivity. We believe to lift productivity means being transparent. It transparency is the number one thing that needs to happen. So the mining operations, the information that flows from one area to another area, from your, let's say, monthly, weekly, daily meetings, it must be transparent. People must know what's going on. There mustn't be what you don't want is you don't want rumors, suspicions, running around. So we say transparency of data and information is core. That should just be a value. There shouldn't be, what are you trying to hide? And don't get me wrong, people are people, so we all make mistakes and we're never all transparent and communicative as we should be. But the truth of the matter is we should ensure that there's always transparency of the numbers and what's going on, what's expected. We find a strange barrier to productivity is people don't really know what they should be delivering on a daily basis. And then we say, well, just, you know, work it out, because you'll be surprised once you tell people we expect X, they actually, they do deliver X. But no one told them before. So they're like, we never knew how to do X, you know. Meanwhile, upstairs, everyone's getting upset. So that's another barrier that we see in productivity. The capability barrier is there. We do struggle with that. But I sometimes believe it's overplayed, because it sounds terrible. But when we go to the mines, most mines are, let's say, even if they haven't got matric, take that away, most of the individuals we work with understand their role and are actually good in their job. We're not finding a bunch of slackers sitting around not knowing what they should do. There are challenges. There are challenges because we're noticing that the technical drilling is a problem right now. The cadet system is being brought in, and we're getting challenged on the community cadet system. People are being put in functions that, to be honest, I would be more cautious about. But that's more like that's a teething issue. Let's get that sorted out, because we have had discussions with companies on, look, the cadet system is a struggle, and just getting people to blast effectively is a problem. That's a technical issue that needs to be solved. But that can be solvable if we put enough time in there. So there is some technical problems on the productivity side. I fully agree. Can be done. And some of it's shooting ourselves in the foot, and others kind of like just history.
Yeah. So I actually wanted to take you just a bit back, Arjun. I think in some of the feedback that you've given me, as well as, you know, from your experience and what you've observed in the industry itself, I do see that majority of it is also the fact that there is a gap in terms of the skills and competencies that people have. But I'm trying to sort of pinpoint where exactly do we sort of miss it? Because university are effectively training new mining engineers, new metallurgists, chemical engineers, and so on. And often you will find that there is a misalignment in terms of what is being taught in universities from a theoretical point of view and versus what is happening in the industry as well. And sometimes in some minds, you'll get comments, for example, from people that are experienced and have been in the industry telling new graduates to leave their degrees back at home. They must just come here and firefight, which is an issue, because certain problems do require that you have a different type of thinking, different type of mindset to be able to, you know, carry the mining industry forward. But in terms of where that gap is, do you think what graduates are learning at universities is actually relevant to what they can go and apply when they get into the industry itself?
From, I remember we had lots of chats with the Wits Mining Institute and that. So to be honest, I think South African students are being well trained in the mining industry, in the engineering aspects of mining and mining itself. I don't think there's a deficit there. I think, to be honest, I think we still I think we still got a thriving mining university environment. I hear in Queensland they've shut down their mining engineering. I hear the University of Colorado, their mining school, which is considered one of the best in the world, that they are struggling to attract students versus in South Africa. I think it's kind of like people are signing up to do work in the mining industry, which is a positive. So that's a plus for us. From what we're noticing of the graduates and what the graduates are learning and studying, I have no problem that it's relevant, that it's needed. And the universities are pretty clued up on where they want to go to. I mean, the future of work stuff, digitization, automation. If you look at the Mandela precinct there that the University of Wits have for the mining side and the stuff they're doing there, specifically being sponsored, I think, by Goldfields and Sibanye. It's really looking at some cutting edge stuff, how the future looks like, you know, how will we fit in. So I don't think that's a problem. What usually happens, and I think it's with every grad, I think it happened with me too, is you fall into an environment and you're young and you're excited and you want to implement what you've learned, and two things happen. One is the environment that you're trying to implement stuff in is not as pure as your study. So you kind of like realize, hang on, I'm going to have to, you know, make adjustments here. The adjustments usually have to be about working with people. So you're usually working with people that are going to be slightly older, or maybe way older, and they have a different framework from you. And so you get a clash of ideas. The old guy says, oh, I've been doing this for like 40 years. And who are you? What? You're 22, 23. Will you come here and tell me what to do? Don't you know, man, you're so wet behind the ears, you can baptize yourself. And like kind of stuff like that. And you're always going to get, that was stuff thrown at me too. So those are the kind of stuff that you got to understand. So what I always say to students or young people is you do need to understand how to navigate people's personalities and people to get stuff done. You can easily say, but I'm right, and you can prove your argument, and you can say, but, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, and it will never change. But what everyone needs to learn is how do you take people with you within your argument or your hypothesis or whatever you're trying to prove. And that's where people management becomes very important. And engineers, unfortunately, are very blunt, or can be. I'm not saying they all are, but they can be very blunt, and sometimes it causes conflict, not because of what they've said, but the style in which they say it. So we always talk about style versus substance. Your substance is 100% correct. It's what you're saying is perfect, and it makes sense, but your style is something you got to work on. You can't stand up to these people, and you might be 100% correct, and they might be 100% wrong, but you got to actually win them over. And just to stand there and start saying, listen, I just came out of varsity now, and this is how it works, and you people don't know what you're talking about, you need to do it my way, doesn't kind of resonate and work. So that aspect, I think most university graduates need to learn is the people aspect. That's more the EQ side of issues. From what the universities are training us and teaching us in, I don't think it's practical, it's doable from what we're picking up.
This brings us to the end of part one with our discussion with Arjun, looking at the key success factors of operational improvement initiatives within the mining industry.
Thank you for listening. Please note that the facts and opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not reflect the position of SIAM or the corporate institution.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.